This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Recording just after the close today, January 20th. This is our episode, 99th episode. I guess we're almost up on 2 years here. We did take a couple weeks off here and there. So that's why we're on 100 next week. For that 100th episode, we're going to attempt to use Twitter Spaces. For those of you that don't like to wait until Friday afternoon, you can hear us live. I think there'll be, as we've heard, there's maybe some confusion about the name, given that it comes out on Friday. When you want to workshop a new name as a Friday after the bell, anytime you want to listen over the weekend to Monday before the bell. But that doesn't really roll off the tongue.
Yeah, I'm not even going to try an acronym on that one right now. But one other thing, too, is we've gotten some comments. Hopefully the sound quality is a little bit better today. I know we had some comments about it last week. So hopefully it's improved this week.
You sound loud and clear to me, Sam.
All right. All right. Feel free to keep dropping the hate, though, or the suggestions if it comes here. It's helpful to us in that sense that if we can improve, we will make that attempt. So
I did hear someone say it sounded like you were talking at the bottom of a well.
Yeah, that came internally. So, from a couple sources. All right.
So Timmy, at the bottom of the well, tell us, where are we this week?
Yeah, so where we are this week, looking at down 65 basis points on the S&P 500. Better sound quality can't help, better pronunciations, I guess. But the S&P 500 down 65 basis points on the week. This is despite a pretty strong day, or a very strong day today on Friday, where the S&P 500 was up 1.9%. So a bit of a drag for the week. But in terms of the leaders, comm services led the way, up 1.3%. Followed by energy, which was up 80 basis points. And to round it out for the positive sectors this week, technology was up 65 basis points. Everything else was in the red. Leading the way down was industrials, down 3.3%, and utilities down just about 3% as well. Looking across the screen here, I see that the lone positive print in terms of the US equity cohort that we look at is the Russell 1000 growth, continuing on its outperformance over its counterpart of the Russell 1000 Value Index. On the week, growth was up 12 basis points positive, and the Russell 1000 was down 1.7%. As it looks for the year so far, the growth is coming back from its dismal performance in 2022, at least on these first short 3 weeks of the year. It is leading the pack. I take that back. It's leading the Russell 1000, at least. It's 4.5% versus 2.7, both positive for the Russell 1000 growth versus the value there.
Yeah, I was looking at the year to date here as you were speaking, Sam, and it was interesting to see communication services with a big rebound, up 10.5% year to date after, you know, it's been having such terrible momentum for, it seems like, the past 12, 15, 16 months now. So it's bouncing back pretty strongly, at least, so, as you said, so far in the first 3 weeks of the year.
Yeah, a little bit of a reversal, something that we talked about potentially happening as we were getting close to the end of 2022. A little bit of that relief rally in there as well, where some of the perhaps we'll see that the worst shall be first, you know, this time around. So we'll continue to monitor that and see how it plays out. But moving over to fixed income land, looking over at the 2-year treasury notes, still the loan tenor when it comes to notes and bonds here on the treasury curve, it's at 4.17% yield. Everything else from the fives on out looks to be having a 3-handle yield. So the 10-year treasury note yield came in 2 basis points. It's now sitting at 3.48. Other way around, bro, for the bond, it was up 4 basis points to close the week at 3.65 for the 30-year treasury bond. Looking at the differential between the 3-month yield and the 10-year yield, it looks like it got a little bit more inverted. Now it's standing at negative 1.19% differential between those two yield points. In terms of what happened with the broad-based U.S. bond index, the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, that was up 17 basis points. In terms of the constituents leading the way, we have agency MBS up 22 basis points. On the tail end, we've got U.S. Treasuries, which were up 6 basis points. But EM was the big winner in terms of the fixed income sectors that we look at here. That's up 77 basis points for the week. On the flip side, the one loan performer there was the high yield corporate credit space, down 70 basis points for the week. So somewhat in sympathy, or exactly in sympathy, it looks like, to the S&P 500, both down 65 basis points for the week. Their high yield and S&P 500.
It's pretty interesting to see that high yield, with high yield down that much and then EM up almost the opposite amount in the opposite direction, same amount in the opposite direction. To, you know, usually they move pretty, you know, risk on, risk off in sympathy with each other. So it's interesting to see them move and, you know, diverge for at least for the week.
Yeah. At least for the week here. And it looks like, you know, perhaps EM's getting a little bit of that tailwind for a week from a weaker dollar as well. Looks like the dollar was down as measured by the DXY index, at least, which is the developed market. So take that into consideration. But that was down 20 basis points on the week, down 1.5% on the month. That had helped commodities this week. Commodity index is measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index, is up 60 basis points, but that year-to-date tailwind in the currency hasn't quite helped. It's the commodity index is still down about 35 basis points or so. Looking at it, WTI crude oil did get above the 80 mark this time, this week, after having dropped down for the past few weeks here. We're now standing at $81.31 per barrel of WTI crude oil. That's up 1.8% on the week. And our friend gold here, or Mr. Kimbrough's friend gold, I should say, is up and maintained a 19 handle there. It stands at $1,929 per troy ounce, up 37 basis points on the week. And then look at this, Jeff, Bitcoin up above the 20 handle there. It's in $22,251 per Bitcoin, up 12.3% on the week, up 34% on the year-to-date basis. So with that, that's the roundup of the financial markets and some of the non-traditional financial markets tucked in there as well. So do you want to kick us off on what happened in the macro front?
Yeah, given it was a short week, as we talked about last week, it was a pretty light week in terms of the macro calendar. No real big releases on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we did get the retail sales numbers. Those numbers came in well short of expectations. If you look at the so-called control group, that came in at negative 0.7%, well below the estimate of negative 0.3%. The retail sales ex autos and gas came in right on expectations at a negative 0.7%. And then the broad index came in at negative 1.1%, where it's expected to be a negative 0.9%. If you kind of look at the headline numbers, the big contributors to the downside were gasoline stations, vehicles, which is why you look at the retail sales ex autos and gas, but even non-store realtors and eating and drinking in the one service category was negative. So a pretty broad miss there across the board for the retail sales. And you would have expected that the market would have gone down on that, on that news. But kind of to buoy some of the markets out there, we also got the PPI numbers, so the producer price index, that also came out on Wednesday. The PPI ex food and energy came in as expected at 0.1, but the final demand, the PPI final demand number came in at negative 0.5. It was expected to come in at negative 0.1%. So it was a very big miss there. Again, this is a miss to the, that's a positive though, because it's going to show that perhaps inflation is slowing down even faster than people were thinking. We did get the year that brought, you know, those month over month numbers brought the year over year PPI final demand to 6.2%, was expected to be 6.8, and brought the ex food and energy to 5.5%, was expected to be 5.6. This was the lowest final demand month over month print since April of 2020. And really looking through that, people started to extrapolate that and think that then maybe there's some possibility of some further slowdown in inflation. We also got the jobless claims numbers on Thursday, as typical. Those actually came in below expectations. So the initial jobless claims came in at 190,000, was expected to be 214. And then continuing claims came in at 1.647 million. That's pretty much on expectation. So again, no trouble there on the labor market as far as continuing claims looks on a week by week basis. And we'll keep an eye out in a couple weeks for the Pizza Friday number. If we move over to some Fed speak on the week, no Jay Powell speak. So, take everything else with a grain of salt. But we did get Vice Chair Brainard was out there saying that the chances of a soft landing appear to be growing. She said that inflation has been declining over the past several months against a backdrop of moderate growth. And the quote, "We're now in restrictive territory and we're probing for the sufficiently restrictive level." New York Fed President Williams also said that inflation is still high and that there's continued supply demand imbalances, and that monetary policy has more work to do to bring inflation down to their 2% goal on a sustained basis. And then Waller was out there this morning, and I like to hear what Waller says because he's typically been on the more hawkish side of things, whereas people think that Brainard's on the more dovish side of things. So if Waller starts to turn a little bit more dovish, you could feel that maybe the overall FOMC is turning more dovish. But Waller said that their goal in raising interest rates is to dampen demand and economic activity, and that should support further reductions in inflation. And there's ample evidence that this is exactly what's going on in the business sector. One of the questions was asked of him whether it's different this time. So it was the other way around, bro, versus 2021, where the Fed was slow to react. The question was, are they going to be slow to react if inflation comes in below expectations? And Waller said that it's easier to do it because it's easier for the Fed to cut rates if it's wrong. So that he's not really worried about inflation getting too low. And then our other ear on the Fed, Nick Timiraos, kind of quote tweeted Waller and then tweeted out, in other words, Waller sees the risk of having over tightened because inflation comes down too quickly as a first class problem. So the Fed is, I think the Fed is certainly in line for a 25 basis point increase in, I think it's February 1st or February 2nd, February 1st is the meeting. The market is pricing in a 3% probability of 50 basis point increase and 100% probability of a 25. So it seems pretty likely that we'll get a 25. And the blackout does start tomorrow, so there's going to be no Fed speak next week. So this was the Fed's, Fed president and vice chair's chance to get out there and talk the market up or down. And it seems like they've talked the market into a 25 basis point increase.
Yeah, I guess so. Looking at the calendar here, we do just have 8 more trading days left before that Fed Wednesday. So. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty interesting one. And just on my side, I'm just excited to hear what the tone of the press conference will be and how Jerome Powell navigates the Q&A session.
Yeah, because now we're going to get a 25. Let's see, the market's pricing in a 75% chance of another 25 in March, or it's March 22nd is the next meeting. And after that, it's all up. It's all up in the air. So we'll see how things change and how Chair Powell talks the market up or down, depending on what they see, or you know, or whether they're data dependent, as I think they're going to say, and they're not going to make any decisions until they get to that, until they get to their meeting.
Yeah, these kind of points where they start to change the trajectory of their policies start to put Jerome Powell and the rest of his gang there in the danger zone, I guess, as well, because you know, as they start talking about the possibility, or you know, the slowing down of rate hikes into a potential pause and no potential cut, you know, perhaps they've been able to do a little bit of smoke and mirrors where people aren't really wondering about what's going on the other part of the hawkish policy, which is the quantitative tightening side. They've been able to sidestep a lot of that, but perhaps as they start to get towards that pause in hikes, then you know, more and more questions are going to come out on the QT side of things.
So remind me to listen to some Kenny Loggins there.
Danger zone.
Yeah. Between the press release and the press conference.
Let's get it going. Yeah.
All right. For the topic of the week this week, we got a question from listener via the Twitter. His name is Another Value Investor, and his Twitter handle is Recovery Trade. It sounded familiar to us, Sam. If those of you that have diligently listened to Monday Morning Minutes might seem familiar to you, but he asked us a question on housing inflation and housing its effect on the CPI. And on episode 85 on September 30th, 2022, we did answer that question from him. And this time he said, he or she, I guess, said that they're noticing that food inflation is decelerating and FAO indices, which are highly cyclical, have turned negative for the past few months. He or she would be grateful to hear our thoughts on whether food costs could transition from inflation headwind to deflation tailwind. And I don't know about you, Sam, but I didn't know what FAO was, so I had to look that up. And the FAO is the Food and Agriculture Organization as part of the United Nations. And so, Sam, why don't you go into kind of what they're, you know, I guess what this listener is talking about, and kind of then we'll go into our thoughts on kind of how we're looking at it.
Yeah. So it looks like, or it sounds like, just like us, Another Value Investor has inflation on their mind, either between food and housing. So with it, let's disentangle what some of these acronyms mean, what we learned and how we started and how we thought through this. But I'll begin with the FAO. The FAO stands for the Food and Agriculture Organization. It's a agency or a sub agency of the United Nations. With it, the index that Another Value Investor is referencing, which we assume is he or she's referencing, is the FFPI, which stands for the FAO Food Price Index there. So assuming we're right there, the FFPI is a measure of the international prices for a basket of agricultural commodities there. And it's they have stated that it is an exported agricultural commodities by a global, basically across the world there. So, and within these commodities, they're broken up into cohort, five different subsets, including meat, dairy, cereals. And I'm guessing cereals isn't like the, what's it called? The, you know, the Lucky Charms, but probably grain. So your wheats, your corn, soybean meal, et cetera. So
it's funny. I was thinking Lucky Charms myself.
Lucky Charms yourself? Yeah. I guess we got to get a packet out there. I don't know if you have one of those sugar free or low sugar versions, but perhaps we can partake in it sometime in the coming week here. But in addition to those three there, we've got oil. Again, this is going to be food oil, as well as sugar as its own standalone character or categorization there. So I guess we all like our sweets. But these are all weighted by the average shares in terms of exports by each one of these groups, going back using the period of 2014 to 2016, which kind of seeing that that grouping there makes me think about what one of the we had an external speaker today talking about changes in the weights of the CPI. So perhaps that's something that we can dig into for a future episode there, as they're changing some of their methodology there as well. See how perhaps it might be impactful to the way that we look at CPI in the future as well. But it could be a good thing to dig through. But the FFPI, again, the FAO Food Price Index, that began in January 1990. During that period of time, as another investor, value investor, points out, it is highly cyclical there. There were 11 periods of consecutive negative year-over-year prints, with some of them lasting several years. I saw, I believe it was in 2006 and a period in the mid-90s that lasted 3 or 4 years of consecutive negative year-over-year prints to the magnitude of, I want to say, somewhere between 20 and 40% on some of those year-over-year prints too. So definitely some high order of magnitude there with regards to the food. I guess you can call it, you would call that deflation during those periods of time. Over that that time, if, when we take a look at it more currently, and what another value investor is referring to is the last 2 year-over-year prints were indeed negative. Back in November, we had a negative 27 basis point print, and then followed up by the most recent one in December, a negative 99 basis point print there. And then when we look at it from a monthly standpoint, the last 9 monthly prints themselves have been negative. So you definitely see a deceleration there into a negative growth for the that price index there. So I guess from that kind of background on the FAO food price index, the question that we have to answer is, how does this translate into price inflation baskets, and specifically those baskets or prices that we as consumers would face? Does this mean it's going to, that deflation that we see in this price index from the UN is going to translate into the CPI most, or perhaps even the PPI? So we broke it down into those two baskets, starting first with the PPI, finished goods category. Again, this is the producer price index that just came out in this last week with regards to the data that we look at through the macro review. But the category that we looked was the finished good category for food producers. And there it measures the average change in prices that are paid to U.S. food producers. And over that same period, going back to January of 1990, we saw 13 periods, distinct periods that saw negative consecutive year-over-year prints. But about a third of those were periods where it only lasted, we only saw one negative year-over-year print. So while there's more distinct periods of deflation, it seems like a couple of them were very short-lived. When we take a look at it on a month-over-month basis, last month was a negative print on month-over-month at negative 1%, but that was the first in perhaps 5 or 6 prints. So no clear trend there yet. But in terms of year-over-year prints, there's no signs of slowing there or deflation yet in the PPI finished goods for food category. That's still at a 15% type of growth on a year-over-year basis. And in fact, looking back in the last 14 months, that category has been a positive double-digit percentage in, again, that last 14 months. One of the things, and it's hard to talk about, but perhaps on the Twitter sphere, Mr. Ferrant there will put up some charts for us. But in the past, when we take a look at these PPI numbers, they tend to wiggle and jiggle relative to the FFPI. So one of the, in those times where they actually do diverge, which is kind of what we're seeing today with the negative print on the FFPI relative to that strong 15% year over year on the PPI, in times of these divergences, it does seem to be that, at least in the most recent last two or three decades or so, that PPI tends to be the laggard and then catches up to the directionality of the FFPI. So as we've talked about in the past, oftentimes we look at PPI as a precursor to what can be expected in CPI, just because it's the producer, the prices that are paid to producers. And then ultimately, they tend to make their way into the prices that are paid by the consumers. So for the CPI, we looked at the food category there, and that measures the changes in the U.S. retail prices of foods and food goods and services. So those are the prices that we as individuals pay. And you can think about it at in terms of a distinction between the food that is purchased and consumed for at home That accounts for about 8.5% of the overall headline CPI. And there is also a category for food that is paid, or the prices that are paid for food that is consumed away from home, so at restaurants or perhaps at in your hotel as room service, but that's about 5.5%. So together, those two account for the category of food within headline CPI, and they sum up to about 14%. So again, looking back at it, going back to January 1990 to keep the dates consistent, or the periods consistent across all three of these measures, the limiting factor here I would note is the FAO index there. The CPI and the PPI do go farther back. But within that same time period, there were two distinct windows of deflation, and that was in 2009 and 2016. Both lasted about roughly a year or so of consecutive negative year-over-year prints there. Currently, the year-over-year print for CPI food is a positive 10%. This is following on seven consecutive months prior to that of also double-digit prints. So definitely seeing some stability there in terms of it doesn't look like it's turning around soon, especially with the fact that the last negative month-over-month print for this category was back in November of 2020. So no signs of slowing there, at least from what we as consumers are paying as measured by the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, for the CPI. So similar to PPI, it's also another divergence relative to the FFPI, again, which is negative, versus these two price baskets, which are positive there. So when we're looking at this, we also broke it down, again, going back to January of 1990, in terms of year-over-year months that the FFPI spent in negative territory, it spent quite a lot of time there. It was 44% of the time we saw in those 384 periods that the FFPI was negative. When you look at it on a month or month-over-month basis, it's up to 47%. You contrast this to CPI. CPI spends very little time in terms of deflation, both on a year-over-year as well as a month-over-month basis. Year-over-year, it was there about 3% of the time. 12 periods out of the 384 periods were spent in were negative on a year-over-year month, on a monthly measure of year-over-year data, I should say, just for clarity. And then on a month-over-month basis, it spent just over 16% of the time there. It was 65 months out of a count of a total of 395. And then PPI was somewhere there in the middle, a little bit closer to the FFI, but there seems to be a little bit of slippage in terms of the impacts of deflation as you get farther down the supply chain from the FAO, which is more of a measure, it seems like, of agricultural commodities, to what is transpires in terms of the price inflation or deflation when it gets to the producers. And then finally, that's definitely is less impactful from a deflationary standpoint when it comes to what the consumers pay for at the retail level from either the grocery store and or restaurants. So that was some of the stuff that we saw in terms of trying to answer the question that another value investor had. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, or if that was enough to suffice for the answering of that question. But overall, it doesn't seem like from that what we just pulled out here that CPI, while you might see some disinflation over the coming months, it's probably going to be a while out again, because the last month-over-month print was back in November, so about 26 months ago. Relative to where we are today. So it's going to take some time for that to trickle through, at least from a deflationary standpoint, but we certainly could see some disinflation, which, you know, could come sometime soon.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you charted them, Sam, and we were looking at it and we're like, oh, the PPI and the FFPI, not high correlation, but you could see they kind of wiggled and jiggled kind of the same. And then we threw CPI on there and it was like, one of these things is not like the others, like the old Sesame Street game when you were a kid. And I would look through the FAO website, and it's kind of a slog, as all of these websites tend to be, to try to get any sort of data. Downloaded the data on the US, what they were using And I was like, well, this looks weird. It looks just like, just like our CPI food numbers. And then I read the, where the data comes from, and it comes from the BLS, and it is just the CPI food data. So they don't have any magic. FAO doesn't have any magic data source. It's just comes straight from the BLS. So it's going to tie out with the CPI food numbers. So really looking at it though, I think you're right that, I guess another way I was thinking about it too, is that it makes sense that the food prices would have a more of an effect on the PPI, and then the producers kind of will hit, maybe they hit, they're hedging some of the price of their goods that they're using to create or to produce for the consumers. And then also, as we've a phrase that's become more popular over the past couple of years, the shrinkflation, where the producers will keep the price the same, but they'll just decrease the size of the package. And so from that point of view, it's actually, you don't really see prices decline across the board. They would rather, or they're very hesitant to raise prices. They'd rather shrink the package, keep prices the same. And then similarly, they're very slow to have prices decline. And they would rather, change the size of their packaging. I think that, something like eggs, which we're experiencing recently, it was a little bit harder for them to make the eggs smaller, or everyone knows it's a dozen eggs. So you can't start selling 11 eggs for the same price as a dozen. So that's why we've kind of seen the price of eggs be so volatile and move around a lot, because it's almost like a fixed quantity.
Yeah, and that's certainly making its way around the meme world, the memes, yep. In terms of seeing those, what do they call those, electronic tracking devices that show whether or not they make the buzzer bop beep as you're going out of the store, tied around the egg cartons there. So hopefully,
I like the one we saw this morning from Ken Shinoda, was like, rich people in 2020 sitting in front of a mound of toilet paper. 2021 was Bitcoin and Ethereum. 2022 was hoarding gasoline. And then 2023 is hoarding eggs.
Yeah. So hopefully you don't have a stash of eggs there. But if you're ever in need, we do have our trading depot, at Jeff post, Sherman's yes. house. Yeah, trading post at Jeff Sherman. So maybe if he's listening, hopefully he's going to keep egg prices low for us. He's done his job. So we'll see.
All right, let's get on to things to keep an eye on for next week. On Monday, we do get the leading index out there, the LEI. That number is expected to come in at 0.7. It's a little bit better than the negative 1.0 that we did get last month. This is for December. So for November, it was a negative 1.0. But we do have positive numbers rolling off. So I would expect that this number to continue to go even more negative than it is currently. On Tuesday, we get the S&P Global Manufacturing and Services PMIs. Those numbers are expected to remain contractionary, a little bit better. Manufacturing expected to go from 46.2 to 46.8, and services from 44.7 to 45.5. Still contractionary though, still below 50. And these ones have been contractionary for a while now. It was only recently where the ISM numbers came in contractionary also. So we'll see. As you mentioned, Jeff Sherman, as he always likes to say, one data point does not make a trend. So we're going to have to kind of see what the ISM numbers come out as. Wednesday looks like a quiet day. Thursday, we do get the GDP number for the fourth quarter. It's interesting, the economists estimate that we're going to get a 2.5%. The GDP, Atlanta Fed GDP Now number is continued. It was updated again this morning. And I believe it's still 3.5%. So we'll see which one's right, whether it's the data or the economists. But either way, above zero, so still growing in the economy. We do get our jobless claims numbers on Thursday, as usual. Just keep an eye on them. And then Friday, we get personal income and personal spending. Personal income expected to decline slightly from last month, but still grow at a 0.2%, whereas spending is actually expected to contract by 0.1%. We'll see. This is for December. So again, we'll see how these numbers shake out. And then also we get the PCE deflator. The Fed's preferred inflation game preferred inflation gauge is the PCE core deflator. That number month over month is expected to rise 0.3, from a 0.2 last month. That would bring the year-over-year number to 4.4, down from 4.7. So starting to look more reasonable, getting down there from a peak of 5.4 in February of last year to 4.4. We'll see if that trend continues. The headline PCE expected to be flat month over month, down from 0.1% last month. And then that would bring the year-over-year number to a 5 flat from 5.5. So again, based on what the Fed governors are talking about, starting to see like inflation starting to become under control, but still at levels where the Fed is going to be worried and still want to keep the Fed funds rate in a more restrictive territory, because the numbers are still high, but at least they're trending in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely all eyes on that Friday print for PCE. As we know, the Fed's going to be keeping their eye out on that. So we'll see. Maybe they get the early look, but either way, they're in that quiet period. So
I think that it's funny, we were talking about that yesterday, the early look. And I think that given their reaction to, or their what's the opposite of no reaction? I guess their no reaction to inflation data, I think it kind of puts to bed the fact that they have secret information.
Yeah, we'll see if that 24% of the mouthpiece, Nick Timmeros, gets any action there too.
Yes. All right. Well, I guess that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to episode 99.
Yeah. And thanks to everyone for listening to us out there. We're still going to be called Monday Morning Minutes, at least, I guess, until the 100th episode, as Mayberry's as a kind of teasing out there, but I hope we keep this M3 moniker here. But don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can find us at your favorite podcast platforms. If you're not able to find it, or if you have any other comments, you want to let us know how our mics sound today, go ahead and email us at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can always hit us up on the Twitter at @DLineMinutes. Don't forget, you can send us some of your questions as well. Just like another value investor here, we will get to that for our topic of the week. And with that, the Monday Morning Minutes.
That's right. Don't forget to check out our website, doubleline.com, YouTube channel, youtube.com/doubleline capital. Reminder for those of you that haven't viewed the Doubleline Roundtable Prime videos, those are very interesting and maybe a little bit depressing, but still very interesting. And also, you can catch the most recent episode of The Sherman Show, where Jeff and Sam talked to Charles Payne. You might know him from Fox Business. So make sure to follow Sam and Jeff on Twitter there at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and good luck out there.
Represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.